You're listening to the World's Robert Crichton podcast, new audio freshly delivered every week, direct from me, Robert Crichton. If you like this audio, consider becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/Robert Crichton to help support my work. And now, your podcast. Metal Harvest, written and performed by Robert Crichton. Music arranged, composed and performed by Richard Fawcett. In 2016, we recorded a live performance of Metal Harvest. It wasn't a perfect recording, but it captured something of the event. This version of the show mixes the live and the studio recording to get the best of all possible worlds. A solo performer enters the stage and sits at a table which is laid out with various props. A toy telephone, a shell casing, a pile of paper, a toy train. As he arranges these props, a musician enters.
Chances of remaining alive by 100% compared with not breathing. I've got more. Hello, I'm Robert. This is Richard. He's going to pretend to tune up for a while. If I go on for too long, then he'll play something random to shut me up. Thank you, Richard. Did you know? Thank you, Richard. Did you know that none of the bullets that failed to fire during the Battle of the Somme hit enemy targets? Did you know that in the final year of the Great War there were more Americans fighting the front line than in the whole of 1914, 15 and 16 put together? Did you know that statistics are rubbish? I don't mean that really. They're very useful for understanding trends and facts and things, but they don't really tell stories. To get at a conflict like the First World War, they're a bit rubbish, but we like to use them anyway, because they're a lazy shorthand to tug at our heartstrings. XXX million people dead. A little lump in the throat, anyone? Why million casualties, anyone? Crying yet? There are enough statistics used in the narrative of the Great War to keep even the most efficient accountant busy for the next quarter of the financial year. We throw numbers about like cluster bombs. The greater the number, the bigger the hanky. But they don't get us any closer to the stories of real people. They merely reinforce a series of cliches about the war. You cannot move for stereotypes and cliches and cant.
So I won't use statistics and numbers against you, as my story utilises only one number, and it is very, very small. This number will help me tell you a story that is largely true. 1.45. That's my number. 1.45. There it is. Now forget about it, because this isn't the story about numbers, this is a story of a shell. One shell. Just one. And what it does to the world. This is it. This is the shell. This is a piece of metal. Just a piece of rusting metal. It's quite old, about 100 years or so, or so. I don't know when it was dug out of the ground as ore. It was sometime or thereabouts in 1914, perhaps. Though if you sniff it, then you can tell. The smelting was done somewhere near Birmingham. Though that probably didn't happen until 1915. It was ordered by a chap called George David Lloyd, Minister of Munitions, whose moustache did a lot of ordering in those days. We needed shells, and he was the man to make it happen, or take the credit, or both. Somewhere along the line, George wrote down or dictated, somewhere communicated, a simple message. The British needed more shells, more and better shells. Somewhere on a bit of paper, this germ, this seed of an idea, swam its way through the bureaucracy of empire, and our shell was conceived.
One order among a sea of orders made its way from Minister George to a functionary clerk. So, we need to get ourselves a clerk. Hello, can you get me a clerk, please? What's that? You can only get me a stereotypical clerk. Well, look, I know it's early in the show, but can you get me someone a little more rounded? Very well, can I have a stereotype, please?
Hello, I'm a stereotypical government clerk. I am, statistically speaking, by the law of averages, mean, median, or mode, odds on 80% privately educated, with the final 20% made up of grammar school boys and other assorted flotsam and jetsam. This means that, statistically speaking, my left leg and my left arm up to the wrist went to grammar school, my torso went to Eton, my right arm Harrow, and everything else went to Windsor, Rugby, and other such institutions, though my right ear went to Dumbleton. Most of my internal organs went on to university, my liver and spleen to Oxford, my lungs to Cambridge, though only my pancreas managed to get a double first, in classics. Of course. Most of my body, statistically speaking, is male, though there must be some female elements somewhere, if only in the cleaning staff. As I am an employee of the British Empire, I am, technically, 42% Indian, 7% Australian, and 8% Canadian on my mother's side. But then, I'm only a stereotype. We don't mention anything so awkward as that.
Hello, Ministry of Munitions. We always hate to miss your customer. what's that? Ministry of Munitions. We're new. Yes, we've just been set up. Let's just create a Ministry of Munitions overnight. No notice for you. That's politicians. What's that? Operator? Oh, there's someone on the other line. Put them through. Ministry of Munitions. Your bayonets matter to us. Minister! Yes, Minister. Of course, Minister. I'll put the order through straight away. Let me just write that out on a fresh slab of paper. That's XXX million shells by next Thursday. Certainly, sir. I get right on that. That's YYY million shells on order. That's the order. That's the number. Now make it happen.
Make that happen. All need to be the same size, shape, design, be transported, and finally, for a few seconds only, used. A few seconds use only, but what a few seconds, but where do we start? Oh, it's easy for some chap called George to say it, to give the order, make the order, how then to order that order, make order where there was none. That's my job. The job of the little cogs in the machine, and I'm just a little cog. But the devil is in the detail, and it's down to people like me to detail the devil.
Hello. Could you get me station, please? Hello, is that the Lord of the Flies? Yes, I need 100 weight of foolscap, please. For before a shell can be made, first we need paper.
We need to fill the forms, sign the papers, stamp the requests, punch some holes, and file, and replicate and triplicate, and carbon copies on my desk. Burn the midnight oil, chase paper trails, avoid paper cuts, paper burns, paper explodes, paper kills. Eventually. How many trees are cut down and pulped? How much ink spilled, pencils pressed, snapped, sharpened before anything moves anywhere? The pen is mightier than the sword, insomuch as the pen can put in an order for a gross of swords, and guns, and planes, and soldiers to boot, as well as their boots. The pen is a mighty useful thing in war. So, what gets ordered? Well,
before our shell can be made, we need the metal. The ore, the fuel to heat it, we need some miners. Let's see if we can find any who aren't on strike. So many regional stereotypes, so little time. Eeny, meeny, miny, Welsh. Get me a Welsh stereotype, please. Consonants. Oh, so many consonants. What's that you want? More ore? Oh, I don't know about that boy, oh, Yakida Flem. Eeks! Ah, you've let all my best men go out to the war. I'm practically running the mine on boys, old men, and close harmony singing.
That's enough of that. There's nothing particularly fun about mining. You are plunged into the dark, covered in dust that gets into your eyes, ears, nose, mouth, lungs, stomach. The heat and the effort, the low pay, the prospect of a sudden death from gas or tunnel collapse. Is it any wonder that so many men joined up, swapping one hell for another? A change is as good as a rest. If it weren't for the coal from these mines, the ship's industry, the centre would not hold, and our little shell could never come into being. From mines, the coal and the ore are dug and loaded onto trains, the Victorian rail network tying the mines and factories, the ports and imports together, so that the coal can be burnt, the ore refined, moulded, spun and turned by countless hands of men and women in factories springing up besides the railway lines. And in one of these factories, our little baby is born.
Where? Where? Where?
Shh, now, I see what's wrong. He's all hollow. Our hollow man needs something to pep him up. Gunpowder? Trinitrotoluene? Amatol? Nitroglycerine? Where? Let's keep it a surprise.
Female Cockney munitions worker, all cheerful in the face of adversity, good for a laugh, but nothing too naughty or I'll suddenly get sharp with you. Oh, time for tea.
But I like to keep myself, as you see, presentable. I may be just a stereotypical female Cockney munitions worker, a cheaper, more exploitative alternative to the male, but that doesn't mean I should stint at being presentable. Standards must be maintained. Well, you've got to, though between thee and me, I can't really be arsed. I'm knackered. You could carry me out of here in a tin box, but after my shift, I'm going out into the town with a couple of the girls, and I'm sure we'll bump into a few young men up to no good. Don't. No, I'm not that sort. The very idea. Besides, there's barely a man available for that sort of a carry-on. Some you see on the streets. Oh. Couldn't manage a salute, let alone get up to the business funny. Oh, there were some queer ones about. The other day we saw one lad on leave from the front, you can tell. The thousand-yard stare, the nervous look, the underlying lack of character. This soldier boy ran up to me and started... Well, it's a bit silly, really. He started going... Cheep! Cheep! And flapping his arms and jumping up and down and... Then he laughed. And laughed. Laughed. And laughed. And laughed a bit more. Had a good laugh, really. Hysterical-like, well. You don't need to say it. We've all seen lads like that. You know the type. Cowards. The soldier boy's mate runs over, you know, to mollycoddle him, and I recognised his friend all right. Oh, yeah, the girls and I have seen his friend's type before. He's the one without the dust of war on his dirty, clean suit. So as he apologised for his friend, I latched my glad eye on him. And he was a beauty. He really was a real natty dresser as well. Had a bit of money, you can tell. So I went up to him. Nice and close, and stroked his lapel, nice and slow, and he looked into my eyes and smiled, and then he looked down, and then he saw the feather just for him. To support our boys. The real men, not the cowards nor the shirking rich. That's why I do it. Because they're dying out there. Excuse me. We're the lucky ones, really. Might not go out tonight. Feeling a bit tired. Flapping his wings. Don't let the girls down.
Canaries.
You could carry me out in a box.
Canaries. That's what they call us.
Doing it. For the boys. Feather in their cap. White feathers. You've
doing it.
Gotta be careful.
For the boys.
In my work, you could blow yourself up.
Carry me out.
Might not.
In a box.
Canaries. That's what they...
Carry me out in a box.
Cheap. Cheap.
Gotta be careful.
Call us. Cheap.
Canaries.
Cheap. Cheap.
Cheap! 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 Cheap!
So, where's our shell now it's made? Can't you tell? It's out to sea on a beautiful gunmetal grey boat. Perhaps captained by a stereotypical salty old sea dog. Ha, Jim lad, you're in a bottle of rum. Or not. I don't actually know what the average salties even at the period would have been like.
The shipping of sea-bound shells from the seashore would be a slightly nervy business, perhaps. Would you like to be sitting in a boat chock-full of high explosives? Well, possibly not. Depends on whether you have infallible trust in British workmanship. In 1915, it's highly possible that half of the cargo would be duds anyway. And we're talking coastal waters here. We're talking the Channel here. We're talking British ports to the south, to-ing and fro-ing to France, and it's fairly safe. There are far worse trips to be making. It's good, regular work, honest work. So, our sea dog has a choice. He could stay where he is, and maybe be sunk by the Germans, and maybe be blown up by the ordnance he's carrying, and maybe get a bit seasick sometimes. Or maybe he could volunteer, be given a gun and a bayonet, and be shot at and stabbed at, and generally be killed. Or he could stay on his boat and do what he did before the war, just with different boxes for different people.
Cross land by train. And cross channel by boat. Our little shell passes along till it is unloaded and loaded. Unloaded and loaded. Unloaded and stored and stored and stored. And maybe some dust settles. How many trains, how many cars, how many carts, how many ups and downs and careful nows and hang-ons, and I'm going to drop this before our shell reaches the field. Statistics do not say. Tommy, plucky, salt-of-the-earth type, joined up for this war full of enthusiasm with my pals. But now I've seen terrible things and will go home a broken man who beats his children. Oh, that said, it could be worse. Oh, you know, I could be the new CO. He'll come down with a dose of shell shock, go mad, nearly be court-martialed, write a slim volume of overrated poetry, before finally dying a few months before the end of the war. I mean, you don't know you're born half the time there, but for the grace of God, go on. Right, sir! Up and down! Up and down! Up and down! Up and down! Now, it's a little-known fact that not no one, had six during the Great War, and certainly not before it. Sadly, the storks of the British Empire will all be killed on the second day of the Battle of the Somme, so we'll have to revert to fucking instead. And yes, the word did exist then. Anywho, I can state for the record that I have never, not once, been caught in the arms of a French prostitute. English, yes, Scottish or Welsh, maybe, but French, never. I have my standards. Though there was that one girl, but Private Cooper insists that she was Belgian. So, hup and down, hup and down, hup and down, hup and down. It's a minority position, I know, but I rather enjoy the war. I mean, the food is terrible, but at least it's consistent. The pay is terrible, we hardly ever see it. And the shelling, your actual fighting, it's nasty work, but most of the time it's just digging or ducking or making a brew or having a fag. I mean, this is a really cushy bit of the line. If it weren't for the new CO, the one who'll go mad and start writing poetry, we'd be living in mud-covered clover, sir!
Up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down.
But he will keep firing at the bloody Bosch, and they don't like it. I mean, they're sitting in their trenches eating their, I don't know, their sausages. And then boom, we fire a shell at them. So what do? They fire back, and it's not fair on them, it's not fair on us, but I don't blame them. It all goes fine till someone gets enthusiastic. Bugger. Unloaded all the shells. Now he'll find me something else to do, sir. Receive the shell, step to the breech, step back, carve the ears, and boom. Receive the shell, step to the breech, step back, carve the ears, and boom. Receive the shell, step to the breech, step back, carve the ears, and have a brew. And wait. No point getting too worked up, working too hard. There's plenty more where that came from. Though only when there's an officer in sight, sir! Receive the shell, step to the bridge, step back, carve ears, and receive the shell, step to the bridge, step back, carve ears, and receive the shell, step to the bridge, step back, carve ears, and have a fag. Can you even fire a shell in anger? I mean, you can a gun. You can unsheathe a blade with rage, but when you have to insert this and pull that, when you have to calculate the range, the angle, when there are so many people involved, can you ever really launch anything in anger? A shrug of shells, firing in indifference, killing by routine, sir.
Receive the shell, step to the breach, step back, carve ears, and receive the shell, step to the breach, step back, carve ears, and receive the shell, step to the breach, step back, carve ears, and receive the shell. Place it in the breach. Step back from it as you send it to the other side, to Fritz with love. Hello, I am a stereotypical German soldier.
Shouldn't a German soldier speak German?
Yeah.
Be more realistic.
Oh, like we're going for realism.
Oh, your show.
Oh, all right, all right. You do the German soldier. I'll translate into English for the English people.
Grüß Gott. Ich bin deutscher Soldat.
Oh, wait. Something's wrong. You're a German soldier sitting in a trench waiting to be blown up by a British shell, yes?
Yeah.
So why isn't the lighting red? Sorry, can we have some red lighting, please? Thank you. Actually, no, not yet. He's not dead yet. Could we have it fade up during this speech so that it's all arty and meaningful, please? Yeah, a 3-minute fade should do it. Cheers.
Grüß Gott, ich bin deutscher Soldat. Stereotyp, natürlich.
Hello, I'm a stereotypical German soldier.
Das heißt, ich bin höchst leistungsfähig und esse gern Wurst.
This means that I'm very efficient and like sausage.
Wo ist die Wurst?
Where is the sausage?
So leistungsfähig bin ich, dass ich die Wurst schon gegessen habe.
I'm so efficient, I've already eaten it.
Oder besser gesagt, wenn's eigentlich was Wurst gäbe, hätte ich sie schon gegessen.
Or I would have done, if I'd had any.
Knappheiten, was soll man tun? Sich beklagen? Ha! Zum Totlachen.
Shortages, what can you do? Complain? Ha!
Und gleich wird hier in meine Nähe eine britische Artilleriegranate fallen.
In a moment, a British artillery shell is going to land within a few feet of me.
Jetzt zieht sie nach oben.
It's going up now. Yes, there it is. It's still going up. But in a moment, down it will fall.
Aber das verstehen Sie nicht.
But you all have some difficulty realizing this, yes?
Haben Sie Billard?
Have you ever played billiards?
Ja.
Snooker? Yes? When you hit the ball, it travels very fast. Moving from the spot with a, how you say, funk. Off the spot and with another click as ball hits ball. A smooth, easy action. Funk, click, clunk, into the hole if you're lucky. Funk, click, clunk. Smooth and easy. Also appears. If you get a camera, one of these modern cameras, and film it so that you can slow down the action, then you can see that the ball doesn't glide across the table, it wobbles. How it wobbles! There's no easy, smooth glide. It spins and wobbles, dances and gyrates, like your Aunt Judy at a wedding.
And a shell, much the same as a billiard ball, just bigger and more horrific. Not a neat, smooth ball, thunk, click, clunk. It's a red, hot, wobbly, dancey, spinny, gyrating mess of metal, fresh from the initial expansion of gas in the barrel, which forces the hot metal out with a muzzle speed of, say, a couple thousand feet per second. After weeks huddled away and banged about, our shell is ready to join the throng and follow in the great adventure. And the shell isn't lonely. Its peers are following it up. Up in the air, these brothers pass each other for the first time since they were turned in the factory, since slim feminine hands explored their explosive tips and caressed their insides. And in the sky they dance together, pirouette and sachet, before saying their last farewells and down again. A fairground ride as gravity begins to win, and finally down, down, down
to the German front line!
Missed.
No!
Squelch.
It's supposed to go bang.
All right, don't worry. Sometimes happens. Big man can play boom time again later.
This is the first time this has happened to me.
No.
Except it isn't. The mud of no man's land, muddy and boggy with shells past and present, is the perfect soft home for our little shell. That's assuming that it isn't a dud, that it can't go bang.
And there it rests and rusts and time passes. Here's what time passing sounds like when you play it on a violin. And while time passes for our buried friend there, what of the other half of our story? Yes, the other half. The other half of our shell. I mean, it comes in two parts. There's the business end, the explosive bangy bit, and the casing left behind, abandoned, ejected from the gun, hot and unwanted, cooling and hissing in the rain. What happens to it next? Well, let's see the options. Buried and forgotten in the mud to rust a little, or recycled, beaten out as useful scrap, or used by the troops and turned into art, or taken home as a souvenir, given away to mothers and cousins and sisters and aunts, or left to corrode in the earth, waiting to be unearthed and given a dignified second life.
As an ashtray on eBay. A First World War artillery shell casing made into a trench art ashtray still retains the copper drive band. Great quality now after a lot of work. We'll ship abroad. Questions welcome. Five in stock. Condition. An item that has been previously used. Not broken or has any broken parts. Some discoloration on the shell. Collect 16 nectar points. Well, no nectar points I'm in. Good condition, but would benefit from a polish. Well, wouldn't we all?
And the years pass, and the years pass, and deep in the earth the shell sits, undamaged, unattached, unexploded. Can you hear the muffled time and the slow backward climb of this rusting metal, aching to escape cold earth, mud cloying of the past, stuck fast, oxidizing bit by painful bit, the proud metal slowly turning in the soil by the action of ploughing above, decades to work up, to worm its way around in the ancient clay, reaching so close for the light, the future, a shoot from the seed of the past, germinating in the present, and with an unseemly awkward clang of metal on metal, the shell is pulled to the surface. When a shell explodes, metal fragments are forced into the air at approximately twice the speed of sound. For those who don't know, that is quite fast. The kind of fast that we haven't evolved to be able to understand. As the shell disintegrates, the metal fragments are, initially, white hot, which we can understand. We can appreciate how hot that must be on some level, how hot this white hot piece of shrapnel is, for a few microseconds at least. Very few will know how it feels to have white-hot metal impact with your flesh at twice the speed of sound. And odds on, if you do, your mind will have blocked out the moment itself, your short-term memory fragmented by the intensity and amount of experience that all your senses are throwing at your brain. It'll be the afterpain you remember. And the confusion. The shell, our shell, this shell, lies astride of the mud for the first time in 90-odd years. It looks clearly wrong in the wake of its resurrecting tractor, which is why the daughter of the farmer, running behind as her daddy works his furrow, goes to pick up the funny fruit, despite having been told, oh so many times, not to play with the things from the soil. But she's eight, and she doesn't listen, or at least she doesn't connect what she's heard with real life, and so, as she reaches out and grasps it, the metal flower blooms in her hand.
I was walking through a field the other day when I came across a piece of my hand. Everyone had looked really hard after the accident, incident, action. Anyway, everyone I'm told had looked really hard to find everything, but they never found two fingers. The rest of my arm was disposed of safely. I think that's what they said. Yes, the remains were disposed of safely. I wondered at the time, did that mean that my missing two fingers were unsafe? Actively dangerous, even. If they ever found the two fingers, would they have to be made safe? A controlled explosion, perhaps? Sergeant, defuse this finger. Made sense to the doctors, I suppose. It was just matter to be got rid of. I don't know how these things work. I mean, I assume my parents gave permission. Though, for all I know, they were given the remains of my arm in a jiffy bag, ready to be posted to my home. I doubt that. But when I was told, I got really angry. You know, the way an 8-year-old can. Because what if I thought I'd need that, my arm, when I got to heaven? That mess, that mass, when I got to heaven. My parents had told me about heaven. They were trying to explain what happened to the dog. Trying to be kind. And then I lost my arm, so that blew up in their faces. But Mummy, what happens to my arm now? I mean, is it in heaven before the rest of me, or will it never be there with me? I mean, if it was in sin, if they burned it, if they burned it, does that mean that my arm's just ash in heaven, or by burning it, does that mean my arm's in hell? I mean, I don't think that now. Not now. I won't go to heaven. I'm walking through the field, and I find this fragment, this piece of bone. And the moment I see it, I know that it's mine. Like I recognise it. This tip, this tiniest tip of my little finger. And I thought, what do I do with it now? I mean, I was angry when they threw it away, but what do I do with it? I mean, it's weird. I've got this tiny bit of it, batch. I mean, do I keep it? Hang it around my neck on a piece of string? Put it in crystal? Put it on the mantelpiece? You know, this little thing's just something I picked up. Or perhaps I should have a funeral. Hold a funeral for my cold, dead hand. I mean, what do I do? And then I thought, and this is horrid. But I thought, I mean, could I have it buried at a war memorial? No, not a war cemetery, because it's a casualty of the war. Of the war. I get compensation. I get a war pension. I mean, don't I have a right to be buried there? Of course I don't. I don't actually think that. I mean, that would be horrid, except I do, because I'm as much of a victim as any other casualty of the war. I mean, what if I had died? I mean, and a bit of me did, but if the whole of me did, if I had died, would I get a grave? Or my arm is in 1915, or whenever. I mean, that's where it is. That's when I lost it. And even though it's 100 years away, I mean, it's as though the Great War is bleeding into today. It's turning, changing into a modern war. No, more so. You could say it always was a modern war, but because of the machine guns and the tanks. But in many ways, it was commendably old-fashioned, because most of the people who died were soldiers, were men who'd been given training, been given guns. I mean, even if a lot of what they were told were lies, that they knew where they stood. But not modern war. Modern war kills civilians, kills children, women, while the men, the soldiers, get the guns, get training, get a chance. We we get fucked. Literally. And it's like the world knows this. And that the Great War has to come in late and play catch up because not enough children were killed. I was 8 when I lost my arm. I'm 20 now. I'm a 20-year-old woman with no arm and half a face. I didn't sign up. I didn't get training. What did I do wrong? Mummy? Mama? What did I do wrong? Maman? Qu'est-ce que je fais de si méchant?
And every day in the fields of France and Belgium, the ploughs hit the soil and dig up more friendly bombs who just want to say hello. And every day trucks drive along to pick up the empties from the side of the road. These deadly milk rounds picking up somewhere in the region of 100 shells, grenades and other ordnance. Every day. The latest crop from the near 1.5 billion shells launched during the First World War. 1.45. It's just a number. But it'll probably be another 100 years before the fields cease to yield up their metal harvest.
Lost the arm, exploding the shell that shone.